From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Baldhead Island sits on the east side of the Cape Fear River at the confluence of the river and the Atlantic Ocean. It's one of the wealthier municipalities within Brunswick County, only accessible by ferry. Baldhead Island's popular reputation is that of an island playground for the affluent. Golf carts, bicycles, and feet are the primary means of on-island transportation. Although it's largely a place of second homes, with the human population peaking in the summer months, estimates of the number of year-round residents range from 160 to 220 people. Baldhead Island also boasts a stunning diversity of flora and fauna. On any given day or night, you might spot a painted bunting perched in a tree, an alligator sunning himself on the golf course, a sea turtle laying her eggs on the beach, or a snowy egret waiting in the marsh. The woman who has spent the last 10 years working to protect these species, some of which are species of concern, and educate the public about their significance, is coastal scientist Dr. Suzanne Dorsey. Suzanne Dorsey, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with the HQR family.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question about the biological diversity on Baldhead Island or any of the species that consider it home, send it to us at coastline@whqr.org. A bit later in the program, we'll open the phone lines. Suzanne Dorsey, do you remember landing on Baldhead Island for the first time after you'd accepted the job as executive director of the Baldhead Island Conservancy? What was your first order of business 10 years ago?
Well, I really thought at the time that I was there in the capacity primarily as a scientist. And I learned very quickly that it was going to be a much broader scope than just cataloging the species and understanding the dynamics. It's been an exciting 10 years, and I've been blessed to learn so much from the people that I work with, the community, and then our broader conservation community here in the Cape Fear region.
And just to put this in a little more context, you have been there for 10 years. You're leaving now to take a job in Maryland. Tell us about that new job.
So it's a wonderful position. I'll have an appointment at the University of Maryland at the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, but I'll be the executive director of the Harry R. Hughes Center for Agroecology. I'll be helping farmers and foresters keep the waterways clean by working with scientists from the university.
So when you arrived on Baldhead 10 years ago and started to take stock of the situation, one of the things you discovered, I know you told me before we went on the air that the mission of the Conservancy is very clear. It's a focus on education, not advocacy. But you are an important part of shaping public policy at the Conservancy.
Right. Now, we work in a community and the whole Cape Fear region of highly educated, intelligent people, many people who have lived here for generations and are connected to our land, who understand it in a way that some upstart scientist may not understand it. So my first lesson was to respect the people who I was interacting with and understand where they were coming from as they tried to live on this beautiful island or in our Cape Fear region. So instead of advocating in a way where I was telling people what I thought they should do, we tried to harness the information that they needed to know to educate them to make good decisions in their own lives and at a broader level, either at the town level or at the state level.
So we know that you educate the public about the biological diversity on the island.
30,000 people a year.
Wow. What are some of the policy decisions that you've had to make or that you've helped facilitate during your time on the island? And what particular populations have those policy decisions impacted?
I think a lot of the policy that has changed while I've been there has to do with coastal processes. So issues around the terminal groin, understanding how nourishment, sandbagging impacts our community, both from the standpoint of sea turtles and lease terns, but also from an economic standpoint, and working with federal agencies, state agencies to help craft decisions that balance all those diverse needs.
as the executive director of the Conservancy, you've had to think about the economy of the island.
Absolutely. You know, without a strong and diverse economy, it's unlikely that you'll have a strong and diverse ecosystem. You know, those government agencies that protect the environment are funded by our taxes. And if we don't have a diverse job base, then people can't pay their taxes, and they certainly can't make donations to a nonprofit organization.
So you've mentioned terminal groins. Erosion control strategy has been, would you say that's probably been the biggest head scratcher for that very smart, accomplished population on the island?
You know, I agree. It really has been a tough, and it's an ongoing decision. As, you know, as the community wrestled with an inlet, and I struggle with that term inlet because I think it's the mouth of a river. Geologists tell me it's still an inlet, but that is a river mouth that has a deep, deep trench cut into it by the Army Corps of Engineers. And that trench causes the collapse of the beaches on Bald Head into that trench. Now, there's an environmental concern about building terminal groins where in other communities you would block the sand from the next town down the line. On Bald Head, that sand would only fall into that deep trench, and a good portion of it is then blown offshore in strong currents. So keeping that sand on the beach in a community that originally built far back, that doesn't have the high density that we saw on some communities that were developed earlier before we knew a lot about coastal processes, this was a community that was affected probably more by that navigation channel than, for instance, sea level rise.
Because this is actually an active shipping channel.
Absolutely.
So there are vessels going along through that trench all the time.
Daily. And it is the Army Corps of Engineers' job to maintain that trench.
And that has been the center of a legal dispute for many, many years.
Well, and again, I think, you know, compromise, trying to find areas of compromise, and, you know, some government agencies are more open to it than others. That's been really difficult to me, where people just literally draw their line in the sand and say, no, this, we're done, we're not compromising, when there are opportunities to work together and collaborate, use good science and good facts to inform decision-making. With the limitations that were handed to Bald Head, they felt like their only response to an engineered problem, an engineered erosion problem, was an engineered structure. And over time, I worked with my environmental colleagues. I worked with the university colleagues to understand, was there a natural response? Could we have done something other than a terminal groin? And other than letting a good portion of the island fall into the ocean, which the Army Corps was fine with, but Brunswick County would have lost taxes, and the community of Bald Head felt like that was not a solution they were willing to accept. They considered it.
What was at stake in terms of infrastructure there?
There would have been, you know, depending on whose calculation you use, you know, millions of dollars in tax revenues lost from homes that would have been washed away. And these, I just want to emphasize, these are not homes that were built irresponsibly far close to the wet sand. These were homes that were built 200, 300 yards back from the first wet sand area of the beach. And in 2009, when they dredged the channel and didn't put the sand back on Bald Head, the beach was coming to within 20 feet of those homes. So, you know, it's a question of fairness. It's a question of an island that made the commitment to live in harmony with nature, to live sustainably, the only sustainably built barrier island in the world. And yet,
why do you call it the only sustainably built barrier island in the world?
You know, here is an island that tried to develop itself by working with nature, by keeping dunes intact, building far back from the wet sand, not cutting down their globally imperiled maritime forest, and keeping 10,000 acres of salt marsh in pristine condition. And by choosing those routes, not only do they have the second highest property value in the state of coastal North Carolina, but they also are probably the most resilient to storms community on the coastline right now. Nature protects and it enhances your value, your property values. So it's a very smart approach to building and to developing on our coastlines.
And so as a coastal scientist, in almost any other circumstance, you would have fought against the legalization of terminal groins, because before Baldhead, back in 2009, when you mentioned, you know, the water was really encroaching on property, at that point, terminal groins were not legal in this state. And many of your colleagues lobbying hard against the legalization.
There's one thing that I think we that are, you know, have learned about coastal processes that we all agree with. Hardened structures are like dominoes. Once you begin building one, you need the next one and the next one. And while I personally resolve or keep my judgment away from these solutions, they are effective solutions. You can engineer an effective solution to certain parameters. Of course, when you exceed those parameters, the engineered structure will fail, and your coastline will therefore fail catastrophically and very quickly.
I do remember one coastal scientist saying to me at that point, please don't lobby for the legalization of terminal groins. I will help you get an exception for Baldhead Island, but please don't make them legal in the state.
That's right. I think, again, this is a complex issue, and in matters of policy, we like to have things very clear, good, bad, you know, right, wrong. You know, these structures are simply that, structures. And depending on the engineering put behind those structures, they can either perform very well or fail. And we've seen engineering in the state of North Carolina perform very well and fail. You know, we've moved inlet successfully and had some failures as well.
And how old is this terminal groin now?
It is almost a year old.
So it's in its infancy. We don't really know yet.
That's right.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Suzanne Dorsey of the Baldhead Island Conservancy is with us today. She served as executive director for 10 years and is leaving soon for a job at the University of Maryland. After this short break, we'll open the phone lines. If you have a question about coastal habitats or public policy related to the coast, give us a call, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking with Dr. Suzanne Dorsey, Executive Director of the Baldhead Island Conservancy. For the last 10 years, she's worked as a fundraiser for the Conservancy, an influencer of public policy, the visionary for this small nonprofit whose influence probably outweighs the organization's size. The phone lines are now open. If you have a question for Suzanne Dorsey before she leaves this area and heads to the next job at the University of Maryland, give us a call, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Suzanne, in a moment, we'll talk about some of the animal populations that are really thriving on the island. But I want to read this email from Roger Hsu, who is at UNCW in the Department of Earth and Ocean Sciences and the Department of Environmental Science, a colleague of yours. He says, I would like to thank Suzanne for doing what I believe all of us in the environmental community should be doing, and that is advocating, okay, you might take issue with that, for our natural systems while also considering the pros and cons of the issues. We all need to understand the realities of our efforts in terms of the environment as well as the societal and economic considerations. I'm going to miss your experience, expertise, sage advice, and most importantly, friendship. Best of luck, but come back and visit an area you helped to preserve and improve. Roger Hsu.
Rachel, if you don't know, this area is blessed with people like Roger. And if those of you out there have not heard Roger speak, he's from this area, born and raised, and he has made such a tremendous difference. There are so many people in the conservation area that make a difference every day quietly. And in maybe in the backwoods, Dan Ryan at the Nature Conservancy, Tony Doster is a wonderful colleague who's done great things, Camilla Herlovic. We are blessed as a small community to have leaders that make a difference every day, and I have been blessed to work with many of them. Thank you, Roger.
And Roger's name is probably going to come up later in the discussion when we get to some of the policy issues that the entire population of Bald Head Island has advocated for mm-hmm. or against. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about some of the animal populations there and how they're doing. The turtles are, of course, almost the signature species for the Bald Head Island Conservancy.
That is true.
How has the turtle population changed since you first arrived 10 years ago compared to where it is now?
You know, when I first arrived, we were in a downward trend. Turtle populations and turtle nesting data has an internal cycle. So, you know, if you laid 120 to 200 eggs at, you know, between 2 and 5 times during the summer, you might take a year off, maybe even 2 years off. And so our sea turtle moms take a couple of years off. So there's a little bit of an internal cycle, which makes it somewhat difficult to determine whether the population is increasing or decreasing. The first 5 years that we were here, we still saw a nice decreasing trend, and we were very concerned. But with the support of Bald Head Island residents and visitors at the Conservancy, we've been able to consistently have one of the highest survivorship, if not the highest survivorship, of nesting sea turtle eggs in the state.
And why is that? What do people do that helps them survive?
Well, one of the things that the Conservancy is able to do is we put 19 and 20-year-old college interns on the beach from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. every night, and they try to intercept every nesting mom. If that nesting mom is naive, if it's her first time and she's put her nest in the right in the wrong place, we're able to relocate that almost immediately. And that allows our nest to have a higher survivorship. And if a storm is coming, we have the resources to relocate that nest. So a lot of it has to do with the volunteers who protect the nest from marauding foxes, or our interns who are out there every day making sure every nest is safe and protected.
And you have a new population of leased terns. For people who don't know what these are, tell us about them.
So leased terns are nesting shorebirds. Many of you may know their cousins, the royal terns. They're one of my favorite birds. They somehow remind me of a 1950s kind of greaser. The royal terns are just so prevalent, particularly in the spring. The leased terns are their cousins, and they're just a little bit smaller. And this year, we've had a colony of between 150 and 200 leased terns nesting pairs colonize the stabilized beach by the terminal groin. We've been
This is by the terminal groin.
By the terminal
groin. So this is an environmental benefit as a result of the terminal groin.
Exactly. So these issues are complex. They're not black and white. And in this case, that terminal groin stabilized the beach, and we have had the wonderful responsibility of making sure that these leased tern nests are successful. And now their babies are running around like crazy, and mom and dad are feeding them, and they're just adorable. You can check out our Facebook page if you want to see pictures of these babies.
That's the Bald Head Island Conservancy. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Suzanne Dorsey, outgoing executive director of the Bald Head Island Conservancy. She's answering questions about coastal habitats, species of concern, how public policy has influenced some of these populations, and the lessons learned over a decade. If you have a question or would like to make a comment, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And we have an email from Amy Hall. She writes, I have had the honor to know Dr. Dorsey the past several years through her role as a partner as well as parent at Friends School, where I teach. I would like to send my deepest and most sincere thanks to Dr. Dorsey for empowering young women to follow a path in science. Your belief that women can and are successful in this field has excited so many of our students to make a positive difference in their environment. What advice do you have for educators to encourage stewardship for all students? And again, that's from Amy Hall and the entire Friends School community. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We will miss you.
Amy and the Friends School, I think they, in a way that few others do, really take to heart outdoor education, environmental education. We know that when kids explore outside, it excites all areas of their learning. and they can take what they've learned and apply it throughout their academics. So teachers, get your kids outside. Let that recess be an opportunity for exploration. And parents, enhance your kids' education by opportunities to block a creek, to dam up a creek, to get muddy, to catch that bug. There is nothing in nature that will hurt your child. And if it's exploring in a wonderful, beautiful, the habitats that we have here, the longleaf pine, beautiful habitats, Pocosins, our Carolina bays, our birding populations, get outside and get dirty, and you will learn every day. Parents and teachers, don't be afraid. Just let your kid explore nature.
You know, sometimes, Suzanne, it surprises me that in 2016 we're still talking about gender and scientists, but there is that reality, and sometimes I wonder, as we become more aware, maybe that's why the conversation continues. But what has it been like? Can you talk about that, being a woman scientist? Is it different? Has it been more difficult or easier than being male in this field?
I think this is an area where all of the change that I have seen has been positive, every single bit. I think I stand on the shoulders of women who bore unspeakable challenges, who gave up so much to be scientists, and I haven't been asked to give up a marriage or to give up the opportunity to go on research boats. Are there challenges? Are there people who will use your gender or make assumptions about you because of your gender? Absolutely, but less and less. And I see my young students, my interns and my students at UNCW having less and less conversations about this issue. So I feel very optimistic. I think we will, as a society, continue to face challenges based on stereotypes that we all hold. But
what are the stereotypes around a woman scientist? What are those maybe unconscious assumptions that people might make?
Well, I think, you know, first and foremost, that you're not technical, that you don't really understand. But I feel that women in leadership are often pushed to the side. And I think it takes sometimes an extra effort for us to sit down at the conference table and not on the sidelines. And, you know, I'm not an advocate of lean in. I'm just an advocate of speaking up and having your say, because your voice matters.
Why do
and
you think
your expertise matters?
Yeah. Why do you think that's harder for women to do?
I think we, in America at least, are taught to be not to toot our own horn. I see this more often in resumes when I help students and I review their resumes. Students, and male and females, but also often in males, well, I didn't want to talk about that. You know, a student who's had an extraordinary experience, had a breakthrough, made a difference, and they feel like, particularly women, feel like they have to be modest about that. On your resume, it's not a time to be modest. And when we as women have got to learn from our male colleagues and to advocate for ourselves and to speak up, to toot our own horn, it's important. And we deserve it, and our expertise is as valuable as anybody else's.
You're listening to Coastline. We have Suzanne Dorsey of the Baldhead Island Conservancy with us today. She served as leader of the Conservancy for the last 10 years and is now moving on to a new job at the University of Maryland. So we are picking her brain about the last 10 years, what she's learned from the turtles and the people on Baldhead Island. And if you have a question or a comment for Suzanne, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Mike Giles with the North Carolina Coastal Federation. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hello, Rachel, and hello, Suzanne.
Hey, Mike.
Hello.
Well, I'm crossing the Cape Fear River as we speak, and I heard Roger Hsu's email. I just wanted to call and congratulate Suzanne on her next adventure and her journey in life. And she has been a stalwart environmentalist and person that everyone can work with, and we're going to miss her terribly. And by coincidence, I have a boat hooked up to my truck, and we're actually going out to Baldhead Island to look at the terminal growing with our executive director. So it's up by coincidence that Suzanne's on the radio today.
Well, Mike, watch out for those least turns. They're quite protective right now, so you might want to bring a hat.
We're going to stay on the boat. We're taking some folks out to look at some of the projects that we hope to be grant funded on the Cape Fear River that Suzanne probably knows about, and we're just going to go out and look at the island and the terminal groin and the inlet and have a good day on the water. But a lot of what Suzanne has done at Ballhead Island speaks volumes to our coast and the sustainability of that island and the lessons learned and the lessons that everyone will continue to be able to learn from what she's done at the Conservancy, and we appreciate it.
Mike, what kind of information are you hoping to gather today about the terminal groin?
Well, as everyone knows, we have sometimes a different position. We oppose those structures along North Carolina's coast. We made some critical comments on the Ballhead groin, and we hope some of those comments help that structure and that engineering to be a better structure. Since we're on the river, we're going to go out and look at it via water, because we've toured the groin with Suzanne on the beach, and since we have the boat out there, we're going to look at it on the water and see what it looks like at Ballhead Island.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to hearing from you about that after you have some information. Enjoy the day on Baldhead, Mike, and thanks so much for your call.
Thanks, Mike. Take care.
Good luck, Suzanne.
Thank you. We are so lucky to have the Coastal Federation in our community. And, you know, I think it's really important for all of us to listen to a diversity of views, to hear Mike, to understand they have wonderful expertise on many issues. So does the Division of Coastal Management. We have great experts in our universities, in our nonprofits, and in our community. And I think it's so important to hear everybody's point of view.
The people that you're talking about, Suzanne, are largely coastal scientists like yourself, correct? They're people who are coming at this from a scientific point of view.
Yeah, most of the people that I'm talking about have some expertise, some background that will help them give objective facts about decisions that are being made.
So during your time at the Baldhead Island Conservancy, you know, you would also consult with the village of Baldhead Island. It is an incorporated municipality.
That's right.
And you would consult with the other large constituency there, which is the homeowners managed by Baldhead Association.
That's right.
And to hopefully develop policy that way. How did science influence or not influence public policy? And where do those two things come to loggerheads? Sorry, I didn't mean to use that particular term.
You know, I think we're living in an interesting time. And over the 10 years that I've been here, I've seen an erosion, sorry to use that word, of trust and belief in scientists. And it concerns me. Science is a process. It is not a collection of facts. And part of that process is disproving facts. So when a scientific theory or principle is disproven, it doesn't disqualify all scientists or all theories, but it is a progression of our understanding of the natural world. And I think sometimes that can be twisted into we can't believe scientists because they were wrong here or there or other places. So I am concerned about people saying, well, just because rat poison has an impact in Yellowstone, or it has an impact in Raleigh, or we see it having an impact in state parks throughout our country, doesn't mean it will have an impact in my community. And that concerns me. That kind of illogic concerns me, because I think people need to understand what's going on in our natural world and understand that some facts you can use inference to draw conclusions about facts that you may not have the money or the resources to gain.
I think back to the year, I think it might have been 2010, when the legislature passed a law on sea level rise, and North Carolina became something of a laughingstock for the rest of the country. Can you talk about that?
Sure. And I think, you know, I'm a critical, skeptical person. I've been taught to be that. So I think some good has come out of the skepticism that people in our legislature had about broad theories that were applied in a global manner to North Carolina. I think as a result, we have improved some of our decision-making tools.
So you're saying with that law that they were just demanding a more refined...
I'm not sure I would go that far, but I think one of the positive outcomes has been a more refined and therefore more effective decision-making tool by our North Carolina scientists for our North Carolina communities. And I think that process, that journey from that law to where they ended up, that was a long journey that required compromise and discussions amongst people that had strong disagreements.
And where are we now with sea level rise?
Well, you know, sea level rise is a problem. Every time that you wonder why they built the Battleship Park in an area that floods regularly, or if you want to go to Southport and eat at a restaurant on the coast and you wonder why it's flooded monthly, that's the face of sea level rise. These places, many of you will remember, didn't flood regularly, at least not monthly. Sea level rise happens monthly, and it's the slow progression. Your real concern, though, and our common ground and the issue around climate change is hurricanes. That's what we need to worry about here. We need resilient coastlines, and the best way to have resilient coastlines is to protect your natural resources.
Is the island semi-tropical or subtropical?
It's considered a subtropical island. We're the northernmost place that sable palms grow naturally. And sometimes the palm growers from Florida come up and harvest our seeds because we've got the most resistance of species or subspecies of our sable palms.
You mentioned rat poison and extrapolating what's been happening in other parts of the mm-hmm. country to what mm-hmm. could happen on Bald Head Island. So there's a rat issue now. Mm-hmm. And what are you, the Conservancy, telling people about how to deal with rats?
We're educating people about sealing up their homes. There's been people who have suffered tremendous damage. And this is not just Bald Head. This is in Wilmington and throughout our region. These invasive species love to live with people. So we're educating about the types of rat poison that have a lower impact on our environment. There are choices.
And I want to get you to explain why rat poison around someone's house could actually influence the natural environment. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a conversation with Dr. Suzanne Dorsey of the Bald Head Island Conservancy. You have one segment left to get your question in. 343-1138 is the number to call, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, we're talking with Dr. Suzanne Dorsey of the Bald Head Island Conservancy. She served at the helm for 10 years and is now leaving for a new position at the University of Maryland. We're picking her brain about the lessons she's learned here, both as a coastal scientist and environmental educator. You have a few minutes left to ask your question by calling 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. And Suzanne, right before we went to break, we were talking about what you're attempting to teach the public about rat poison. People are finding infestations of rats around the island. Of course, this isn't just Bald Head. This is southeastern North Carolina. It's an issue. But you are concerned about the kind of rat poison that people might be using, because why? How does it get beyond someone's property into the environment? What does it do?
This is a perfect example of the challenges that homeowners have in making good decisions. So they are being told that there are EPA-approved drugs that will destroy the animal and eradicate the population. Unfortunately, once a rat population is established on an island or in a community, it's near impossible to eradicate it. So given that, what are the choices that a homeowner has? And they'll hear from exterminators one thing, they might hear another thing from the conservancy. So we try to give them options. If poison is the way that they want to handle it, then there are options like cholcalciferol, which has been proven to have a lower impact on wildlife. Even though wildlife may not directly consume the poison, they do consume the dead or dying rat. And we see its impacts in our predator population, foxes, and our raptor populations as well, like our hawks and our owls.
You also have had alligators on the island since, certainly before people ever settled the island. And do you think that the folks on Bald Head Island have a better understanding of how to live with alligators than maybe folks on the mainland in North Carolina?
We have sure tried to make that a reality. Alligators are a wonderful draw for our tourism industry, and they're important predators. They play an important role in the ecosystem of the island. They are apex predators, so like a large shark or like a grizzly bear, you have to have respect for these predators because they can be dangerous to human beings.
And how, if you could get a message across about how to deal with these alligators, I mean, right now, there's more and more encroachment happening on the mainland. Mm-hmm. Subdivisions are popping up all over Brunswick County, these areas that have typically been swampy areas right. before. People are building houses there, and they're finding alligators much more regularly
right.
in their retention ponds. And so what happens is a phone call gets made to the alligator guy. He comes out, throws the gator in a tube, and hauls him off, allegedly somewhere, to be relocated. But what do you think about all
right.
that?
And the State Wildlife Resource Commission is working on this. I think the first thing, the first important message, all parents must teach their children that when you approach freshwater in southeastern North Carolina, you have to assume that an alligator is there. Alligators should not be harmful to adults. They shouldn't be a huge risk, but they could be to smaller children. So all children should approach freshwater with caution, and we as parents need to teach our children that. Secondly, I think it's very important to understand that unless they're fed, these animals will not consider you to be a threat or to be food. So please don't feed or approach alligators. At the same time, you have to assume the person before you did feed that animal. So the best thing you can do, stay back. The Wildlife Resource Commission will evaluate the animals to determine to see if they are a danger to human beings. And if they are considered a danger to the human being, they will allow them to be relocated. Now, this is where I personally think that we have a problem in the state of North Carolina. The folks that relocate alligators in North Carolina aren't doing it every single day. It is an area of expertise that we lack enough expertise. And so when that animal is removed, they're usually handled in a very harsh way, a manner that stresses the animal. I've heard of situations where the animal sat on the back of a truck in the heat for hours at a time before it could be transported. And then the question becomes, where do we transport it? In Brunswick County, you often hear of people saying that they transport it to the Green Swamp, which is in private property. It belongs to the Nature Conservancy. And
how does the Nature Conservancy feel about that?
My understanding is that they do not give permission for people to relocate alligators there. When you've stressed out an alligator and then you dump it into a pond, that pond probably has another alligator. And it's very unlikely that the relocated alligator will survive.
So you're saying relocating the alligator is probably a death sentence for that alligator.
And if it's a death sentence, perhaps we can find a more humane way of eliminating that threat to human beings.
Are you saying that you think it would actually be kinder to euthanize them instead of trying to relocate them?
In my opinion, the state should consider euthanizing alligators that are considered dangerous to human beings instead of relocating them. Yes.
What are some of the other areas around alligators that we don't fully understand? Because we don't really, is it fair to say that we don't have a very developed alligator management policy in this state?
I think that you see most homeowners associations relocating and removing alligators, and the result of that removal process is a destabilized population. On Bald Head, what we've tried to do is maintain our population by allowing there to be one or two large gators. Where we have one 13-foot gator on Bald Head right now, and that gator regulates the population. He does it through cannibalism. It's not pretty, but our population has been stable over the 10 years. There's only been about 22, 26 alligators on Bald Head.
And this 13-foot gator is not a danger to people.
At the Conservancy, we evaluate the gator, and if we have a concern or if our constituent at the village or property owner feels that it's a concern, we do ask the Wildlife Resource commission to come over and confirm our analysis that it's not a danger to human beings.
And how do they confirm it? What are the signs that a gator has become dangerous?
If an alligator approaches a human being without that human being having food or doing something that would otherwise attract that gator, splashing in the water, doing some kind of prey maneuver. If an alligator naturally moves towards human beings, they're considered a danger.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Suzanne Dorsey of the Baldhead Island Conservancy. She's nearing the end of her tenure there before she goes on to the University of Maryland. And we have just a few minutes left for you to get your question in. 343-1138 is the number, or coastline@whqr.org. Randy from Southport, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. The situation on Baldhead Island with the alligators can be very, very obtrusive to the basic population over there. I used to work over there several years ago, and as doing so, I saw several alligators that were right good size, as a matter of fact, anywhere from 10 to that 13-foot size that we were just discussing. What's very alarming, which most people, I don't think the general populace is aware of, that an alligator can run up to 20 miles per hour. And when an individual is 10 or 15 feet away from an alligator, that's within their range of being able to, if intimidated, they will approach you. And that's a scary concept.
Well, Suzanne Dorsey, respond to that.
Randy,
Randy, thank you so much for your question.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I think it's important to understand that these animals are lion-weight predators, so the way that they attack their food is they hide and they jump out and grab that. They can jump up to 4 feet. So for those people hanging over a dock or something, they can certainly jump up. So they absolutely represent a threat. Again, they do not typically chase their food out of the water. The only time I've ever heard of any kind of incident was when somebody was fishing in a freshwater lagoon and ran away with the fish still attached to its hook. The alligator did come out a certain number of feet from the lagoon chasing that amazingly walking fish. Otherwise, these animals don't prey on human beings and chase them down, typically.
And we have Anita from Sunset Beach. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was listening with interest when you were talking about the problems with rat poison, and I was waiting for you to mention perhaps a more natural approach to rodent control, the maintenance of a feral cat colony in the community. I know in Sunset Beach, where I live, on the island as well as the mainland, and on Ocean Isle Beach, we have volunteers that feed and care for feral cats, and the rodent problem is taken care of naturally.
So rather than seeing the feral cat population as a problem or a pest, Anita, you see it as an important part of the ecological system.
Yes, it is, and we've done a real good job with TNR, which is trap, neuter, and return the cats, so we don't have an overpopulation problem. And when the cats are trapped and brought into the vets for their spaying or neutering, they are given a one-time rabies shot, which generally will last for the lifespan of a feral cat. Typically, after they're neutered, their lifespan is about 6 years.
Suzanne Dorsey.
And they're no longer a problem.
Can you see a feral cat population? Is there a feral cat population on Baldhead? Anita, thank you so much for your call.
Anita, that you and volunteers like you have really made a positive impact in dealing with feral cats in many locations. On Baldhead, we are an important birding area, and we are blessed that we don't have feral cats on the island. And that's really been in large part because the community, anytime there's been a cat loose that doesn't belong to somebody, they have adopted it and brought it indoors. We care so much about our bird population that we don't see feral cats as the solution to rats. But there are other solutions like sealing up your homes.
And we have Darlene from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline, Darlene. You're on the air. And Suzanne is smiling and squinting. I think she's ready for some love.
Okay, we won't cry. I'm cleaning a bathroom and listening to Coastline.
You sound like you're in a bathroom.
I'm echoing. I'm in an empty place. So But I just want the people on Bald Head to know that they could not have found a better advocate or educator for Bald Head Island and the Conservancy than Suzanne Dorsey. I had the privilege of going to camp down there with her. She took kids from Wilmington, from our neighborhood, and we commuted to Bald Head, and so I got to see a little bit of her commute daily, and she totally is committed to that island, has been committed to the education of the general public in Wilmington, of Friends School children, of the North Carolina Legislature, of the larger Resources Commission Board, Coastal Resource Commission Board, and hats off to her, and the Bald Head Island people need to be very appreciative and very picky in whom they choose next to follow her.
Thank you, Darlene. Darlene, thank you so much for that lovely tribute to Suzanne Dorsey. There will be big shoes to fill. That just goes without saying. We have to get to some of the larger policy issues that Bald Head Island has tackled and actually influenced. And I'm thinking right now of offshore drilling and seismic testing when the Obama administration announced that the Mid-Atlantic region, which would include areas around Bald Head Island, was going to be open for that. Your constituency lobbied hard, and since that happened, the Obama administration has announced what, Suzanne?
That there will be no offshore drilling, and we're thrilled about that because there are impacts certainly for wildlife, flora, and fauna, but also importantly for our coastal tourism issues. So we and our community were absolutely in lockstep, believing that this was a great outcome for our region.
And offshore wind, is that still a possibility for this region?
Yeah, my understanding is that it is still a possibility, and that has been an area of contention. I believe that our coastal communities, who are at the forefront of sea level rise and climate change, have got to support innovations that will help reduce those impacts. And wind is a tough one because we care deeply about our viewsheds in this region. And that's
about your what?
Viewsheds, about what things look like offshore. So I believe that there probably needs to be more innovation in technical solutions for wind. And if that comes to pass, and with the protection of viewshed, maybe it's a possibility here. Right now, there's still some technical issues that need to be overcome, it seems.
Well, can you talk in more depth about some of those technical issues? What needs to change before it would be acceptable?
Well, I think, we're concerned right now about the economics of it, and I'm excited to see one of the
because
maintaining large turbines offshore is expensive, and does it generate enough electricity to be economically competitive with natural gas resources or onshore wind or solar, and I'm not sure that equation has hit yet. However, our private industry is the one who has most of those solutions. The way the process works with BOEM is the leasing will occur and will be allowed before the community has the opportunity to look at what those solutions are. I just wish we could have a more open and transparent conversation about what these leasing companies are looking to put out there. I know our community is fighting very hard to move the distance offshore, and I think that could thwart the economic viability of the wind farms.
And so, you want to move it farther offshore because you're afraid that will impact the real estate values on Bald Head.
And I think people feel strongly about looking out at that beautiful open ocean.
That's this edition of Coastline. Rats. Dr. Suzanne Dorsey, it's been a pleasure having you on today.
Rachel, so great to see you. Thank you for having me.
Coastline is now back on a Wednesday-only schedule for a couple of months. In September, we'll fire up the Thursday Coastline once again in time for our political coverage. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes Store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.